All right, everybody, we're back with episode number 7 of Sinful Cinema, and this is TL Bug talking to you. As always, I'm joined by my wonderful co-host, Reverend Phantom.
Hello, folks.
Yep, there he is. So, this week we've got a special show planned for you, but I'm not going to tell you about that quite yet. I'm going to hold off for a second, do my begging up front. I figured out that I've been doing my begging at the end of the show, and maybe people aren't staying around for the begging, so I figure if I get it over in the first, 2 minutes, then people might check that out first.
Let's give that a try, yep.
All right, well, it stands to reason. All right, so first off, we'll have no feedback at the end of the show because nobody sent us any feedback, and we've got a ton of listeners out there, it seems like, and it seems like y'all would have something to say to us, be it good, bad, ugly, or otherwise, and we want to hear from you. So please send us your feedback. I think we've got 700 people, is that right?
Yeah, over close to 750, I think.
We'll see. We've got just shit tons of people out there listening to us. So, we know you have something to say. Please say it. Email us at sinfulcinema@charter.net. And if you don't want to scribble down that address or whatever, you can head over to sinfulcinema.com. And there is a link in the upper corner there where you can get in touch with us. And please do. We really want to hear from you about pretty much anything that's on your mind. Hopefully pertaining to movies.
We need constant love and affection to keep this going.
That's right, we do. And there's only so much we can give each other before it gets kind of strange.
We're very needy people.
We are. That's true. We admit it. It's all right. But I'm sure some of you people out there are needy as well. And what you might needy is some free shit.
Yay.
Yeah, free shit. It stands to reason. And so you know how you can get free shit? You can be one of the people that reviews us on iTunes before the end of March, and then I'm going to put everybody's name in a hat, and I mean literally, I'll go get a hat and put people's names on it. I'll take a picture if you'd like, and I'm going to draw out a name, and one of those lucky people is going to win a prize pack of all kind of genre film goodies. It's going to be new wrap sealed stuff that I'm sure you'll enjoy, that genre fans will get into, probably some horror, probably something Italian. Who knows what might be on there, but it's gonna be a mystery prize pack of sinful goodies, and all you have to do is review us on iTunes. That sounds pretty simple, doesn't it?
You'd think.
I would. That's why I'm saying it. So head on over. I'm sure lots of you are getting this off iTunes already. Let us know if you're in another country and reviewed us. Send us an email so we know, because I sometimes switch around to the other countries so I can check, and there aren't any there either, but just in case, let us know and we'll put your name in there, and I'll ship shit to who knows where, Kalamazoo or whatever. I don't care. Timbuktu, Timbuktu 4, wherever you're at, I will ship shit to, and you will get delicious free goodies, and everybody loves delicious free goodies.
Delicious free goodies, free shit, it's all good.
Yeah, all of it. So, there we go, that's the end of our begging. I didn't get down on my knees this week, but if we don't get anything in the next couple weeks, I probably will, which won't really work because this is an audio format, but I'll have to just tell you I did.
Yeah, don't make us go in there and write our own reviews, because that's just sad.
It is just sad, but, you know, I'll do it, and then I'll pull my own name, and then I'll just buy myself shit.
You'd do that anyways.
Well, yeah, but this way I can feel justified about it, because I'm like, hey, look, I won! Yay!
I'm somebody!
Right, I'm special. Well, I'm already somebody. I'm in the phone book.
I'm not. Humor.
Oh, you're not. I'm probably not anymore either, but that's beside the point. I mean, anybody that wants to go around looking up TL Bug in the phone book, feel free. If you find me, good on you.
Escort services.
Well, that's on the side. I wasn't letting everybody know about that. So anyway, we should probably get around to the show proper. We're almost 5 minutes in, and we've not told you anything about what we're doing this week. So I guess it's about time we tell you that. So we're going to be talking this week about Sergio Martino, one of our favorite Italian directors. And this episode is going to be wall-to-wall Martino talk. So tell the folks a little bit about what they might know Mr. Martino for.
Yeah, Sergio's got a few films that there's even some of the people who aren't necessarily Italian film freaks might be familiar with. He did a film called Torso, which is basically a prototype for the American slasher. Mm-hmm. And we'll be talking that one a little bit more in depth later, as well as Mountain of the Cannibal God with right. Stacy Keach and Ursula Andress.
Right.
And he dabbled in just about every genre. He did science fiction, 2019 After the Fall of New York, mm-hmm. and Hands of Steel. Hands of Steel will be our bizarre treasure.
Right. Lots of Paco Korak talk in your future.
Paco. And let's see. Another more famous one, I guess you could call it that, is Island of the Fishmen, also known as Screamers. Mm-hmm. In the States. Kind of one of those movies that was on every video store shelf back in the day, and the video box actually reflected nothing about what the movie was about, but it looked cool anyways.
It did, but no, it did not mean anything with this movie at all.
If I recall right, the cover was like a skinless person, like in a black background, like coming mm-hmm. at you, and right. Yeah, that's really, wow. Nothing to do with the movie.
Not at all. But you know, that's kind of a little indicative of Martino's career. I mean, not only has he had to use a billion alternate names to put on his movie, including Julian Barry, Martin Dolman, Serge Martin, and my favorite, George Romito. Mm-hmm. He's kind of known for making kind of trashy, fun films, and he knows that. Mm-hmm. So before we're going to kind of go through his whole catalog, and well, not whole catalog, but the ones that we know something about, and talk about them real quick here. But I want to start off with a quote from Mr. Martino that I think really sums up. Not only how I feel about his movies, but how he feels about his movies, too. So here it goes. Sergio said, "My movies are like a soft drink. Sparkling, effective products for mass consumption. A soft drink doesn't have the prestige of champagne, of course. But I'd rather have a good soda pop than watered-down wine anytime." And I think that's right. I mean, I'd mm-hmm. much rather see a Sergio Martino movie than sit through some pointless art film that I will have no idea what happened in the end.
Right, and I think that says a lot about, you know, his style as a director, as far as he kind of gets lumped with the Deodato and Lindsay and Fulci, but he's really nothing like those guys, or even Argento. I mean, he's kind of got his own thing. He's got a little bit of an American sensibility to his movies.
Right. I mean, in his way, he was making popcorn movies.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, this was at a time when, you know, in Italy, there weren't, you know, televisions weren't widespread. People were going to the movie theater, like, every night. It was, like, the place to be and, like, congregate and whatnot. And so he made movies in all kind of styles, and he drove people into the theater to see these things. And that's what they were looking for, is good romps that were entertaining, that, you know, you could kind of float in and out of a little bit and still really enjoy.
Of course, and these are popcorn movies, but with an Italian flavor.
Well, yes, you know, popcorn movies, you know, popcorn smeared with marinara sauce, if you will.
Right, because I mean, even in comparing, you know, popcorn movies from the States to even to Italy. So I mean, there's still a difference there. There's still a little bit of a, and I hate to say it, a little bit more of an artsy quality to their style of directing over there. That's just, it's different from here, but genuinely just there for entertainment.
Right. I mean, American movies, I don't want to get on a huge tangent, but I always felt like American movies were kind of born out of the tradition of getting people into the theaters and filling, you know, butts and seats. And a lot of Italian movies were, you know, after, you know, fascism kind of waned and whatnot, post-World War II, I mean, they kind of came out of, you know, art films were, you know, made a big statement in Italy. And I think, you know, their genre films grew out of art film.
Right.
And I think that's very different than, you know, basically American films started with genre and eventually got to art. This started at art and eventually got to genre.
Very true.
So I think that's a big, you know, difference when you're looking at these films and kind of the perspective of them. And I think that's important to remember. But, you know, let's start shooting down these films. And, you know, kind of get through here and let people know what he's about.
Well, do you want to get into, like, his pre-directing days?
Or... well, yeah, I think we should touch on that for, you know, just a second. I mean, he did get his start working with Mario Bava on The Whip and the Body. He was the second AD on that, uncredited, but that did kind of get him his foot in the door. So to speak. Also, his grandfather had been part of the film industry in the 30s and 40s. And so he kind of had a family tradition to go into there. And his brother, his brother's name is Luciano, who we'll be talking about later, I'm sure.
Great producer of many, many great Italian films.
Indeed, and the man who bagged Edward Finch, so he's got to have been done something right. So, you know, his brother was already producing and whatnot, so that kind of got him into working on The Whip and the Body, and it wasn't but a couple years later, I believe 3 years later, maybe four, that he made his first film all to himself. And he started off with a Mondo movie, which of course was sweeping Italy. And the first one was called Mondo Sex.
And his first three movies were actually documentary Mondo style movies. Both all three, I think, pretty much evolving sexual themes.
Right. Now I don't think either of us have seen any of these movies. So we can't really comment on them, but they are interesting, and Mondo movies in general are a pretty interesting phenomenon.
One interesting, I think it was Violent, or Naked and Violent is the one of the Mondos, and I think it's, or was it, I'm not sure, okay, it's either that one or Mondo Sex, I'm not really sure which one I read about, but basically I thought it was interesting that it was shot in America, going around and finding the taboos in American culture, where a lot of those movies were dealing with stuff around the world, and not really focusing on American taboos.
Right. That appears to be Naked and Violent.
There you go.
So yeah, that's definitely, I would definitely love to check that out sometime, just to see what the kind of the Italian perspective on these American sexual taboos would be at the time.
And then from there he went into where a lot of Italian directors went and made a spaghetti western.
Yep. With Arizona Colt, another movie that has eluded me, I have not had a chance to see it, but I'm sure I'll catch up with it sometime.
It does sound interesting. I've not seen it either.
Next up is a film that I believe you've seen, but I've not seen, and that's The Strange Vice of Mrs. Worg.
Yeah, this is a good one, also known as Blade of the Ripper. It's another one of those that I remember seeing on video store shelves back when before I even knew that, you know, Italians made movies. If it was in the horror section, it was obviously an American movie. So,
right.
But yeah, this is Scott Edwish Fenech, and it's, and I believe George Hilton, I believe, is
yes.
in it.
Yes, he is.
And it's a good mystery. It's a little slow moving, probably for a lot of people's tastes. He would definitely improve on that. I think touched on how his movies are, you know, popcorn films and kind of not necessarily as artsy fartsy as some of the other Italian directors. This, I think, was his attempt at being artsy.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think it, I think he probably found that it wasn't his liking.
Right.
Because it seemed like he kind of made a shift after that.
Right. And then he followed that up with another giallo, the Case of the Scorpion's Tail, which I believe is another one that we haven't seen.
No.
But we have seen 1972's All the Colors of the Dark.
Yes.
And I believe this is another one that I feel that really does have a strong art influence to it, because there's a lot of shifts between fantasy and reality. Once again, starring Edward Finch as a woman that gets drawn into a satanic cult of sorts. And it's a pretty interesting little film. I think it's very visually interesting, although I do think that some of the shifts back and forth make the film pretty confusing.
Yeah, there's a bit of that, and it definitely Bava-esque.
Yeah, definitely so.
Which is always a good thing. But what I really liked about this film, and this is something that kind of would carry on to the rest of his films, is in especially in Torso, I noticed watching it again recently, that there's a look to his films, and I'm sure it has to do with the cinematography, and I wish I'd looked up who exactly the cinematographer was for this film, but there's just a great look to the films, I did a review of this a few years ago, and I made a comment about how, like, the dead leaves, it's like you could smell them. They're so vivid. Everything's just so lush and so vivid that it's like it takes you there. It's like you feel like you're in the film. And there's a scene in Torso, and I'll get to that later, that I had that same feeling with. And it's just, for being, you know, popcorn movies, he's the example of putting a lot of detail and a lot of effort and thought into his films.
Right. This was, the cinematographer, looks like this is the first time he worked with Giancarlo Fernando. Who did many, many movies for Martino for years and years to come.
Right.
So a lot of the films we'll be talking about today were made under his eye, and then eventually he made, you know, Troll 2. But don't hold that against him. I mean, what could you do? He couldn't make Troll 2 look any better than it was.
That has to do with the old shining a turd kind of a thing, I'm sure.
Right. Moving on, he made another giallo in 1972, the lengthily titled Your Vice is a Locked Room and Only I Have the Key. Now, this is one that I really enjoy. It's kind of a telling of the Black Cat with a whole lot of changes to it. Again, starring Edward Finch and Luigi Pastilli. And I'm trying to think, is it Merrily in the third part? No, it's Ivan Rasimov.
Right.
Kind of the boyfriend. And I really like this one. It's got a great kind of feel to it and mood to it that really captures me. And it moves along very well. It's probably definitely up there in probably my top five favorite giallos. Because it's one I've gone back to many times and checked out again.
Well, we're gonna probably differ on this one. I don't think I liked it as much as you. It's not that it's certainly not a bad movie, because I've seen some pretty damn bad giallo movies, and this isn't one of them. But comparing to his other body of work, other films in his body of work, I don't know. There's the ending is awesome. I will give it that. I freaking love the ending. But yeah, I felt the middle was a little dragging. It drags a little bit in the middle, and Yeah, I couldn't. I couldn't get into the pace of it, but it was kind of one of those Italian films that comes. I found this with Lucio Fulci's The Psychic that I saw recently. And it's like kind of like the middle part's kind of like okay, where is this going? And then finally, it gives you this really great ending, and so.
Right. I think this one might have a special place for me because it was probably, I think, the second Martino film I ever saw. And it was definitely in the early times of the first two or three giallos I ever checked out. So I suppose I probably might be a little biased because it was such an early kind of, wow, check this out. Kind of hit for me. Now, 1973, he made Torso. Now, we're not going to talk much about Torso because we're going to do a full review of Torso in a little while. So I'll move on to his next 1973 title, and that's Giovanna Longthigh. He moved into a sex comedy mode for this one.
And he would return to sex comedy quite a bit after this. You might even say that was kind of his... Really, his forte was the sex comedy.
Right. This is, you know, we've talked before on the show about how Italian comedies are hit and miss. This one definitely had some miss moments to it, but again, it stars Finch, and she's looking real hot throughout the whole thing. So, honestly, that buoys the film quite well. But I enjoy it. It has some silliness to it. It's a little too broad at times to where I'm just like, seriously, this is a little too slapsticky even for me. But overall, I think it's a pretty good title.
I didn't enjoy this one very much. And I don't think it has anything to do with Sergio Martino. It has everything to do with it being an Italian comedy.
Right.
Which my main problem with this one in particular is... God damn! I mean, I don't have any problem with lowbrow humor. I mean, I'll laugh at a fart. You know, I'm just kind of that guy. I'm that kind of a guy. But I mean, God, this really seemed like it was written by like 12 and 13 year olds, like, hee hee hee, boobs, hee hee hee, that kind of like humor, like,
right?
Wow,
that's a lot of Italian sex comedy, and that's where I found my sticking point with it is because you look at comparable comedies made stateside. You know, in the same kind of years, and you go like, well, these are kind of smart, good comedies, and why in Italy were they doing this? I don't quite understand, but I mean, that's just a cultural difference.
It is a cultural difference. I think something that's probably endearing to some people, not to me, because I really don't give a crap, but it's that I think there's a little bit of a playful innocence involved in their... in their comedies or sex comedies where the America's just way more vulgar. I mean, give me Porky's right. as a sex comedy any day over something like, you know, these movies, but,
sure. Well, in 73, he was a really busy guy.
Yes.
And he also squeezed in time to make, The Violent Professionals, a Polizia film with Luke Miranda. And, you know, as far as Polizia films go, it's not too bad. I like Luke Miranda. He has a kind of a charisma that I can really get into. It co-stars Richard Conte, who many people know as Don Barzizi from The Godfather. Mm. And, you know, it's a pretty interesting little film. It definitely, you know, is cut from that, you know, Dirty Harry cloth.
Mm-hmm.
You know, kind of a cop working outside the law, and that's just how it's going to be. It's a good movie, but, you know, in the scheme of Polizia films, it's not going to be one of the ones you're going to have to run out and see.
Yeah. As far as his Polizia movies, I don't think I've seen any of them. You said you've seen Gambling City, right?
I did. That's probably the next one up the list that we could even touch on. That's okay. 1975's Gambling City. It's less of a Polizia than a Eurocrime film.
Mm.
It's really more about, you know, people gambling and double crossing each other and whatnot. I saw it a long while back, and I didn't review it for the site, and I don't have a great memory of it, but I remember that it was spectacularly colorful. Just like a wash in just rich colors everywhere. And I really liked that, but the movie itself was, you know, middling to not so good.
Let's see. From there, yeah, we neither of us have seen this, but Sex with a Smile, I think, was probably one of his biggest, at least one of his biggest comedies.
Right. Yeah, that's one I've been meaning to catch up with. But
I believe that did. I think that did good in the States as well. And it features the freakish Marty Feldman.
Oh, I definitely have to catch up with that then.
Whom always just scared the crap out of me when I was a kid.
I love Marty Feldman. Anything he's in, I will pretty much check out. So I'll definitely have to redouble my efforts to see that one.
And from there, he did one of the last spaghetti westerns from 1977, A Man Called Blade, with Maurizio Merli in the lead. I dig this film. This along with Enzo Casolari's Kioma, and Lucio Fulci's For the Apocalypse, one of the three last big-time spaghetti westerns that really kind of went in a completely different direction. I think what happened was all three of those directors were kind of, they went into the giallo thing and kind of got the giallo vibe and kind of carried that over into these westerns a little bit, which gave them a completely different flavor, and it's not, that flavor's not going to be for everybody, because they are very artsy spaghetti westerns.
Right. Yeah, I've seen the other two, and I've seen this one, but I played this one time when I had people over, and I didn't have a whole lot of time to concentrate on it, so I don't really remember it much, but I remember it looking great.
It definitely looks great. I think what would throw people off is the score, which it's the DeAngelis Brothers score, which they stuck with Martino a lot. We haven't brought them up yet, but right. He did use them a lot. But this one's out there as far as the score, and I think it throws people off a little bit because it's there's something very I'm just gonna say operatic, but that's probably not the right term I want to use. But there's singing involved in the music. Same with. Right. Same thing with Kioma and For the Apocalypse. So, yeah, and I think a lot of people go, "What the fuck is this?"
Right. Speaking of what the fuck is this, is 1978's The Mountain of the Cannibal God. Now, this is another one we're going to talk about later, so we'll kind of push that to the side for a moment and talk about 1979's Island of the Fishmen, another what the fuck moment that we've mentioned earlier. It was called Screamers in the U.S. And it starred Ringo's main squeeze, Barbara Bach. And I believe it had Joseph Cotten in it as well. And Claudio Castagnelli, who's in tons and tons of Martino's films, I'm sure. Well, I know definitely we'll be bringing him up again.
Yeah, he was one of the main players of Martino's films. I don't know. It was starting with Mountain, I believe. Might have been the first one.
I think so. Island of the Fishmen is kind of some silly fun. I mean, it's the fishmen look terrible.
Oh yeah. But,
I mean, the film itself is kind of fun in that kind of like throwback to like if I thought that he was intentionally trying to make a Roger Corman type film. Then this would be like the perfect, like, hey, he made a great Roger Corman homage. I don't think that's what he was intentionally going for here, but I really like the film nevertheless. I understand Screamers is cut pretty heavily, so if you're looking for this one, I recommend checking out Island of the Fishmen. I think you can get this several places, but I know Cinema de Bazaar carries this one, so you can check that out there.
Yeah, this is like his first step into, like, I'd call it a creature feature.
Yeah.
So, I mean, and I, he may or may not have been going for a Roger Corman thing, but, you know, he does pull it off. I think the film reminded me, if it was a little less violent, it would remind me of a lot of the kind of Disney movies from the 70s. I'm not talking about the animated movies, but like...
Right. Escape from Rich Mountain and right. stuff like that.
Yeah, it was kind of thing I expect to see like as the Sunday night movie like back in the late 70s or something like that.
Yeah, that's pretty much true. So I guess we should move on to 1979's Big Alligator River.
And you've not seen this one?
I've not. It's been one that's been on my must-see list for a couple years now, and I still have not gotten around to it.
Kind of the same vein of Fishman, how it's just kind of just goofy, fun. I'm not really into nature run-amok movies, and I like this.
Okay.
So well, I think that says something.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I like nature run-amok, so I probably will really like it. Well, moving on to 1982 with The Scorpion with Two Tails, kind of going back to a giallo type of form. This is another one I haven't had a chance to check out.
This would probably get my vote as his worst film.
All right, well, good to know. Don't check that one out. And we'll skip right on up to 1983 when he did the post-apocalyptic 2019 After the Fall of New York.
Yeah, this was around the time when post-apocalyptic movies were really big in Italy, and this is one of them. It's I enjoy it for what it is. I really like post-apocalyptic movies, so this is one of my favorite Martino movies.
Yeah, I like it too. I mean, it's definitely kind of cut from the same cloth as Bronx Warriors and a lot of those other movies that kind of came out the wave of films that took off a little bit from Escape from New York.
And it's got Michael Sobkov, which, you know, I'm a huge fan of.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that's definitely one of the best reasons to check out this movie. This is another one that was available in many, many formats. I know that the last time I watched it, it was on videotape, and it was cut to crap. So, you know, watch out which version you get, and make sure you're getting the full-length version if you want to check that one out. So probably don't get videotape. And I think we only have one more movie either of us have seen in his catalog, post that time, I'm missing, Hands of Steel from 86, which is another one we're going to talk about in a little while. So the last one we do actually have anything to say about is I saw Casablanca Express, many times years ago, actually, because, I was a big fan of Sean Connery, and then when I heard that Jason Connery had made himself an acting career, I thought, well, I have to see what his movie's about. So years and years before I knew anything about Sergio Martino, this came out in 89, so I probably saw it in the early 90s, I would say.
And what's the verdict on Casablanca Express?
Well, I've rewatched it recently, and I mean, it's kind of like a little bit of a takeoff of Von Ryan's Express, which you can kind of get from the title, and, you know, it's a Nazi war type of story. Jason Connery, Donald Pleasance, not so good. However, this is one that, I'm a big fan of going to the dollar stores and looking through their bins of movies.
All right, yeah.
And this one can often be found for a buck. And for a buck, well, it's not so bad for a buck. So, you know, I mean, definitely not a high recommendation, but one that, you know, for a dollar, you ain't got nothing else to watch.
I'd buy that for a dollar.
Exactly. Other than that, in his later career, neither of us have seen any of his more recent films, in the 90s, or, lately he's been, looks like he's been directing a lot of TV in Italy. I know one that sticks out to me that I really like to see is, the sequel to Island of the Fishmen, called The Fishmen and Their Queen from, 1995, apparently made for Italian television. And that's one I would love to see if there was an English dub or a subtitled or whatever. That's, even though it's been widely panned, I would still like to know what he decided to do for a sequel to that.
Now, something else I've noticed probably from looking over is his whole filmography on IMDb here is he's one of those directors, like just, you know, like the other ones that I mentioned earlier, that kind of they made the kind of movies that were popular at the time when Gialli were popular. They made Gialli films when the Spaghetti Westerns were popular. They made Spaghetti Westerns. And when post-apocalyptic movies were popular, he made those. In the early 90s, it looked like he got into the erotic thriller, which right. was popular in the early 90s. So he kind of was very, he kind of stuck with that through his whole career.
Yeah, and I think that's common through a lot of Italian directors. But I think, you know, Martino definitely could blow with the trends, and a lot of things, you know, he did pretty equally as well. I mean, he did some good action, he did some good creature features, he did some good giallo, and, you know, he did a spot of everything and did it pretty well. Some things better than others, but, I mean, he's a workman director that, you know, did a good job at what he did.
Yep.
So, I think that about wraps up our overview of Sergio Martino's films. And as you see, he's got a ton of films that we didn't even get a chance to mention, mostly because we hadn't seen them. So definitely a director that if you don't know anything about him, there are tons of places to look and kind of start getting into his filmography. And we definitely encourage you to. And we're going to give you some more encouragement when we come back here in just a minute. I'll tell the people what we're going to be hearing here in a second.
We are next. We'll be talking about Torso, and so we'll let you hear a bit of the original trailer for that, which is pretty hilarious, but it's pretty cool too.
All right, so we'll be back in just a few minutes to talk about Torso.
Now, from Carlo Ponte, the man who brought you Dr. Zhivago, comes a totally new motion picture experience. A journey into the bizarre, terrifying world of the psychosexual mind. So, it saturates the screen with terror.
I've called you here today for a good reason. What do you have here? Are fragments of...
Is one of these students a psychosexual killer?
...murdered just 1 week ago.
Or are they just playing erotic games? Not so innocent erotic games. Eager to test the limits of pleasure. A killer is stalking.
Well, that's a real good start. Why do all hang-ups come my way? Honey, even if you're queer or impotent, you're paying the price I charge just the same.
A psychosexual killer is stalking.
Bitch.
What's happened?
That guy was spying on us.
Sean, what do we care if he was? Come back, Sean.
A killer who takes his pleasure differently. Torso, a gripping motion picture about a killer's perverted hunger aroused to an animal frenzy. Torso, it saturates the screen with terror.
All right, we are back, and that was the trailer for Torso, which, like I mentioned, is kind of hilarious, but kind of cool at the same time. See, Torso, as I mentioned earlier, this one really laid the groundwork. This one and Bava's Bay of Blood really... kind of laid the groundwork for the American slasher. A lot of people could say, you know, Gialli in general kind of brought about the American slasher, but those two films in particular really kind of embody what, you know, movies like Halloween and Black Christmas and the movies that came after that, Friday the 13th, were kind of all about, but...
Right. I agree with that, because kind of both those movies, both Torso and Bay of Blood, focus a lot less on the mystery and a lot more on somebody's killing a bunch of people.
Right. It's not about... I mean, it in a sense, it is about who's the killer, but it's more about, like, how is this person going to survive?
Right, exactly. Yeah, it's much more survival horror than it is, you know, kind of edge-of-your-seat thrills.
Because, I mean, not to give anything away with Torso here, obviously there's a killer that you don't know who he is until the very end, but I kind of figured it out pretty easy.
Yeah, I mean, this one, I think of a lot of Jale like to bring somebody out at the very end that you don't suspect at all and go like, oh, this person. And right. I don't think this is one of those, and I think that's another reason that it definitely embodies the slasher move towards that and away from kind of like the drawing room mystery.
Yes, this one is someone is strangling co-eds in Paraguay. The only clue is that the killer owns a red and black scarf, and the police are stumped. American exchange student Jane and her friends decide to take a break from classes by going to Danielle's uncle's villa in the country. Unfortunately, the killer decides to follow, and women begin suffering a rabid attrition problem.
Okay. Wow. All right. They're not dropping out. They're getting killed. That's a little misleading.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, this a lot of this movie comes down to the fact that... if you're gonna wear a scarf around your neck, you know, don't make it a really memorable one.
Right. Yeah. It's kind of like, you know, if you got a big tattoo on your arm, roll down your sleeve before you start killing people.
Right. Before you start killing people, just take your ascot off. It's not really too much to ask there, Fred.
But, of course, somebody else in the film is also wearing a scarf, so yeah. It's like, who did it? This guy wears a scarf, that guy wears one, so...
Right, yeah, that's actually probably one of my favorite scenes, the confusion over scarves.
Red on black, now black on red.
Yes, exactly. That definitely makes me laugh a good bit. This does, you know, embody several of the normal things you're going to expect in a Jolly. I mean, you have the killer with the gloves, and you have, you know, a foreigner in another country. You have incompetent police. You have people doing things like going to a remote cabin for no apparent freaking reason.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it does have a lot of hallmarks of it, but like you said, it really just boils down to people getting killed.
And another thing that carried over into the American slasher films is with a lot of giallo films, they rarely show the person like from the shoulders up.
Mm-hmm.
And this guy's got a mask. This is a masked killer, which obviously, you know, almost every slasher movie after that has a masked killer.
Right. Yeah. And this is definitely the prototypical, like, when you think of a masked giallo killer, it is this. I mean, he's definitely using the traditional kind of killer that, you know, kind of Bava came up with in Blood and Black Lace just years and years before.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, this film is typical of Martino that it not only has good thrills and everything, it has a great look to it.
Yes. Oh my God. I said I was going to get into this earlier. The scene where the girl wanders out from the stoner party out into the forest, and she's barefoot walking through the mud.
That's like, great.
Oh, dude! It's like you can feel it. You can you could feel the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. You know, misty and foggy and.
Yeah, he did a really good job with that. Really creating tension.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's probably what he did best in this film for me is just the moments where you're expecting something to happen, that you know that it's just any minute gonna happen. I think that's really where this movie shines for me, is that it'll get me really like sweaty palmed and actually like sitting up, like leaning into the movie, you know, like even though I've seen it before. and still being like very into it and whatnot as it goes on.
And that scene that I described, is it's fairly early in the film. It's probably like 20 minutes in, you think, something like that?
Yeah, somewhere around there.
And, you know, prior to that, I remember watching it the first time, just kind of going ho-hum, like, you know, okay, this is okay. But then once it hits that scene, it was just like, oh, wow, okay. Yeah. I'm on board now.
Yeah, it kind of lets you know what the film's all about. Because the setup does feel a little slow towards the beginning, but like I said, it's all, like, just about 20 minutes. And then once it hits that scene and keeps going, it's really hit its stride.
And one thing, you know, I have to point out that which is pretty prevalent in a lot of Martino's films, there's lots of TNA.
Yeah, there's definitely lots and lots of TNA on display in this one. And definitely having a cast of nubile young ladies encouraged him to probably put more in.
Oh yeah, there's some beautiful women in this film.
Yeah, definitely. There's some beautiful women, and there's Luke Miranda. So, lucky Luke Miranda, I guess, is what we're saying.
Yeah. So what about the cast? What do you think of overall of the performances?
You know, overall, I think everybody was pretty good. I mean, a couple of the girls were obviously not the best actresses. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they were serviceable, and pretty much the ones that weren't really good were the ones that ended up getting killed quickly. So, you know, overall, I thought it was good. Susie Kendall, that played the main girl, Jane, she was definitely a strong actress, and I liked her very much. I think she was in something else that I've seen. I know, Bird with a Crystal Plumage.
Right, yeah.
That she's also in, and she's a pretty good little actress, and I enjoyed her performance in this one.
Yeah, comparing her to, you know, some other female actresses that would be in American slashers, yeah, she was definitely pretty good. Overall, there wasn't really like a performance that stood out was like, oh god, that's horrible. So I mean, yeah, everybody just did kind of what they were supposed to do, I think.
Right, yeah, I agree. I mean, nobody really stood out, but I mean, this is, like we said, was a prototypical slasher movie. I mean, when you think back on slasher movies, unless there was some famous person that was in it that sticks out in your mind, like Kevin Bacon in the Friday the 13th or whatever, generally all those people seem to run together.
Right.
And when I think back on this one, even though I've seen it a couple of times, they all tend to kind of be lumped together in those girls that get killed.
Yeah, there's not really a standout performance by anybody, but nor does there need to be, because it's just not that one of those. It's not a vehicle for some big name actor. It's just one of those movies, just a popcorn movie to get you in the seats and just kind of thrill you for an hour and a half.
Right. When Luke Miranda is the biggest name in your film, that kind of says it all. This isn't that really a film about the cast.
Because I'm sure some people are going, who?
Exactly, folks. Exactly. Luke is not exactly one of the top echelon of Italian stars. Definitely not one that people are like, oh yeah, Luke Miranda, he's awesome.
Now, this I mentioned them earlier, the DeAngelis brothers, Guido and Maurizio DeAngelis, they provide the score here. Right. And I think it's a pretty... They've had some better ones, but this is definitely a good one.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think they shine a lot more in action films.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah, or definitely.
Their Polizia work. But, yeah, I think that they provide a good score here, and it definitely adds to what he's trying to do with creating an atmosphere and tension.
And I think the music plays a lot of really making it... I mean, it's an Italian movie regardless, but the music really makes it an Italian movie, because it's like you didn't hear that kind of music in horror movies at that time.
No, not at all. But, yeah, I mean, Torso is definitely is one that I didn't catch up with until fairly recently. But then once I did, like I said, I've seen it several times, and it holds up every time I've seen it, even though knowing what happens at the end never affects my enjoyment of the whole movie, because, like you said, it's pretty easy to figure out what's going to happen.
A few things I want to mention here is the gore in this film, and I same for Bay of Blood. It was way ahead of its time.
Mm-hmm.
You didn't see movies quite this violent coming anywhere really. Because I mean, unless you're talking about the really goofy, like, Herschel Gordon Lewis stuff.
Right. Well, I mean, this is a step further than a mannequin leg painted red at the end.
Right. Although, and I have it noted here, that the head crush scene by the car I thought was pretty bad.
Yeah, that was pretty bad. That looked more like a watermelon just getting smacked with the car.
The funny thing is, it is they show it. It's a dummy head when it gets crushed. And then they cut back to it, and it's the guy again, and his head's not really crushed, but there's blood all over his face. It's like,
yeah.
Wait, so his head got crushed and then just popped right back again like a...
Well, I mean, that's a little known fact, that when your head gets crushed by a car wheel, the oxygen that is blown up the car wheel will actually come down into your head and then blow it back up once the car is not on your head. I mean... You can check on that. I mean, I'm not a scientist, but I'm pretty sure that's true.
Or his head was made out of, like, one of those stress balls.
Right. It could have been that. It was Nerf head.
And another thing I wanted to touch on, I thought there was a line in the film that the professor in the beginning of the film says, sometimes professors get bored with books and have to visit the originals to gain our perspective. And I think that could be said about slasher films, and this mm-hmm. being one of the originals, because there's a lot of cliches in this that weren't cliches when this first came out. And it's just, so if you watch enough slasher films, like, you know, I'm sure you have and myself, that it kind of, like, gets repetitive and kind of, you know, you kind of be like, oh, I got another fucking slasher. I know how this is going to be. Kind of got to go back to discover these films to really get a perspective on, you know, how good they really were.
Right. I think, a lot of these Italian horror films that we like do serve to just enhance what, you know, we grew up watching. Just American schlock from the video store.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, going like, hey, that part right there, like, that's kind of like from this movie I remember from the 80s. Well,
right.
You know, I think that's great to see where those kind of conventions came from, and they came out of movies like this. So I definitely agree with that.
So I would definitely say to people who are into slasher movies, go discover some of the early stuff that you know, especially if you're a slasher fan, because, you know, you got to go to the roots to find out, you know, what, because if there was no Torso, Bear of Blood, there would, I don't know what would have happened. In horror in the States.
I mean, it's hard to believe that there would have been a Friday the 13th or anything like that. I mean,
right.
I mean, those people that made those movies were some of the first people who had seen these movies from overseas.
Mm-hmm.
When, you know, this was not something that, you know, you could pop over to Netflix and watch on demand. These were things you really had to work and dig for if you wanted to check out.
You know, there's always a lot of big debates with horror fans of whether it was Halloween or Black Christmas, which, you know, were the first slasher movies. Like, no, Torso and Bay of Blood were the first slasher movies. So definitely, if you're into horror, discover the roots, man. Go back and discover Torso.
Yeah, I definitely can't agree more with that. And this is definitely one people should check out, and one of Sergio Martino's finest films in his catalog.
Mm-hmm. I agree.
Yep. So I guess we're probably both going to send this one to Cinematic Heaven, I would think.
Yes.
So this gets our highest recommendation. So this is one that you should definitely check out or add to your collection, add to your catalog of films that you can talk about. This is a great one to watch by yourself, a great one to invite people over to watch. I mean, this is a film that would have a broad appeal to a lot of people. So We definitely both think you should check this one out, and well, so you should.
Do it!
Yeah, we said so. So do it. Got a problem with that? I don't think so. Alright. Alright, well, after that, a little bit of machismo, we will leave you here with a trailer for Mountain of the Cannibal God, and we will be back in just a minute to talk a little bit about cannibalism and Ursula Andress and pig fucking.
Yay!
Yep. Pig fucking.
Is it innocent? Unauthorized expedition?
What are you looking for?
Very tired. This is a low state radio. Please.
Please help me. I don't know if Henry's still alive. But until I'm certain that he's dead, I'll keep on looking for him. Even if I have to do it alone.
I think the only person who could help you is Professor Edward Foster.
This is the Maribata jungle. It's the area where they say Henry disappeared. 5 miles offshore is the island of Roca. The island is covered by a very dense jungle which surrounds and protects the sacred mountain of Rarami. Sacred because the natives believe that the mountain is cursed.
No, wait! My name is Manolo.
Yeah.
She was attacked by a native. She'll be all right.
He was a member of a tribe called the Puka.
Why is everybody so scared of the Puka?
They were the ancient inhabitants of Rarami.
In their language, Rarami means Mountain of the Cannibal God.
Papa! Wakala, rock! Wakami! There's a risk of gangrene.
He's burning up. It was crazy to let him come.
If he insisted on coming along, it means he has his own very good reason.
That's right. I have mine, you have yours, just as Henry had his.
What's yours?
You want the truth? Your husband knew that Rarami possessed resources that could bring him wealth beyond imagination.
When we reach us, rich!
And don't forget the taste of human flesh!
Those cannibals forced you to partake in their rituals.
Yes, and it was horrible.
And we're back again, and you've heard a trailer for Sergio Martino's Mountain of the Cannibal God. Also, sometimes known as Slave of the Cannibal God.
Yes, and also featured the DeAngelis brothers again, which is another pretty good score as well.
Yeah, definitely. In a nutshell, let me tell you a little bit about what this movie is about. A girl and her brother fly to New Guinea to look for a lost expedition led by her husband, who has vanished in a great jungle. Well, that's not exactly right. He's vanished on an island. And they hire Stacy Keach, who is playing Dr. Edward Foster, to guide them there. Unfortunately, the island is populated with cannibals, as islands are prone to be done. So this is one that I want to say this might have been... No, this was this after Hands of Steel. This was the second Sergio Martino movie I checked out. And partially on the strength of the fact that it stars Ursula Andress, who I just love. Of course, Dr. No is where a lot of people know her from, rising out of the water in that white bikini.
Mm-hmm.
This was many years later. Miss Andress was 42 at the time, I believe. Still looking way better than a lot of other 42-year-olds do. So that's what first attracted me to this picture. At the time, I'd stayed away from a lot of other cannibal films. I had not seen Holocaust yet or Ferox or anything like that. So this was kind of my first experience with the cannibal film. And so this was my first experience with animal violence in a cannibal film. Which, when you're dealing with Italian cannibal films, you pretty much got to expect it.
Yeah, and there's a connection to the Mondo movies with these Italian mm-hmm. cannibal films that they felt there was some need to keep it real. And, you know, it's like, well, we're in the jungle. It's like, what can we show that's shocking? So animals being killed, which, you know, well, I actually think we should probably just both say right here that, you know, we're both not pro that. We're definitely against the animal violence of these films.
Oh, yes. The animal violence parts of this film, or any of the Campbell films, are gratuitous. They're unnecessary. They don't really serve any purpose in the film. I mean, I've theorized before that, you know, not only to be shocking, but a lot of these films put the animal violence in. So, especially I apply this to Holocaust. So they show you, you know, like a crocodile being cut open and everything, and it's real. And so when they cut open a fake person in the same way, you're still remembering the real violence that you saw a little while ago. So even though it looks bad, that's still in your mind, so it reflects through there and makes it more horrifying.
So there was a half-assed purpose of putting it in there, but it was still half-assed.
Maybe. I mean, it's not justifiable at all.
Right.
And so in this movie, you get, I know they cut apart a monitor lizard and eat it. There's a fight between a bird and a snake. But perhaps the worst part of this movie is the monkey and the crocodile. Basically, you get a scene where a monkey's head gets thrust into the jaws of a waiting crocodile. And for about probably 3-4 minutes, you have to endure watching this monkey struggle as it tries to free its head from the crocodile's grasp. Now, if this wasn't a setup shot, that would have been, you know, already horrifying. The worst part about this is when you see the film, I mean, it's quite obvious. You can slow it down and see it much better, but it's easy to see that the monkey has some kind of collar on it and is trying to be disguised by leaves, but he is definitely pushed into the waiting mouth of the crocodile. You know, this was my probably third time through watching this movie for this review. The first time I watched it, I did sit through it because I wanted to see the movie in its entirety. Now, when it gets to that scene, I can't watch it. It's too much.
Yeah, we should probably mention right here that we've both seen this. I've seen it a couple times. You've seen it a few times. We watched it today. You saw Mountain of the Cannibal God. I watched the edited version, Slave of the Mountain God, which we were kind of talking before the show, what scenes were cut. That scene actually was cut.
Okay, well, that's
from Slave.
That's good. But you said that a lot of the other animal violence was
The more like, you know, Animal Planet Discovery,
right,
you know, kind of stuff was still there. There's a scene where a big turtle's fighting an alligator, which I thought was actually pretty cool.
Oh, right. Yeah, that one's not bad because it doesn't really get super violent.
It's like, that's a turtle fighting an alligator.
Right. That is pretty cool, but I mean that's like some Wild Kingdom shit right there. I mean, you know. But I mean the monkey scene, watching there's a documentary that was on the disc that I have and Martino talks about it. And, of course, he denies responsibility for it, as most Italian directors have denied responsibility for it, basically blaming it off on distributors and producers and people who wanted that kind of thing. And he also states that, you know, basically, you know, like, oh, we were just in the jungle and it just happened, so we filmed it. Mm-hmm. And that's just bullshit. I mean, call it what you will, but, I mean, obviously this monkey was thrust into the mouth of the crocodile. It was just, no way in hell was this just a natural occurrence.
Yeah, and I think, not to excuse it in any way, but I think this, it possibly might go back to a cultural thing yet again, to where, obviously, this type of stuff was repeated in so many other Italian cannibal movies that, obviously, they just did not have the same take on that subject that, you know, Americans did as far as, like, animal violence and stuff like that, so.
Right, definitely. I mean, this would not fly, I don't think it would fly in Italy now, much less here. I don't think that would, I mean, these, you know, stars that were in this movie, Ursula Andress, Stacey Keach, I mean, obviously, Andres was kind of past her prime and kind of making some foreign films to make do, but Stacey Keach was just starting his career, really. Mm-hmm. This would ruin him now.
Oh,
if
yeah.
If he was in a movie that had that kind of animal violence in it. I mean, this would just, it would just be over with.
Giovanni Lombardo Ridice was in Cannibal Ferox, and he's pretty much condemned his, you know, any part he had in that film.
Right.
Which a lot of actors have, but he's really been like, yeah, that was really fucked up.
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, this monkey scene, this is one of those ones that comes up in other films. They used it again in Eaten Alive. Not Toby Hooper's Eaten Alive. The is that Lindsay, I believe?
Yeah, I believe that was Lindsay, yes.
Yeah, I think it's Lindsay's Eaten Alive. He just co-opts that scene and just throws it into his movie. And it's just, it's a horrible scene to watch. Of all the animal violence that I've watched in all these, Italian cannibal movies, this one's just the absolute worst for me. After the first time I saw it, it just bothered me for fucking days. But I'm going on about this probably way too long. Because there's way more to this movie than that. That probably happens within the first 20 minutes. And really, most of this movie is backloaded to the last 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
One thing I would like to say is I thought this movie looked great. This is another example of you know, Martino knew how to get the best shots and everything. A lot of it reminded me very much of how stylish a movie like Herzog's Wrath of God was, you know, in its filming of the jungle scenarios.
One thing I would add to that is, I believe Blue Underground is the one who released it. Got a million kudos to them, because watching Slave, oh my God, they did such a great fucking job with Mountain that it's, if the first version I had saw was Slave, I would have been like, this is shit. I mean, I actually think it's shit anyways, but I would have never ever watched it a second time, definitely. So they did an incredible job.
Right. Well, you know, since you're mentioning that you think this is shit, and I find it, you know, average or a little above average at least. Tell me a little bit about what you think about this. Why do you think it's bad?
Well, and I should preface this by saying that I fucking love Italian cannibal movies. I mean, that's one of my favorite subgenres. It's I wrote a paper on it in my psych class, and it's actually one of my I kind of rewrote it and released it as an article for B through Z on the history of Italian cannibal films. But this one, it's certainly not the worst, because the only reason it's not the worst is because of Sergio Martino. But goddamn, the pace of this film really sucks, and like not much happens until this gratuitous ending where they like just shove as much. And I'll give it credit for actually setting the example of where cannibal movies would go after it, whereas the last 20 minutes is this big gratuitous thing. Movies that followed it, like Holocaust and Ferox, actually tried to make the whole movie like the last 20 minutes. Right. This, first of all, we should say right now that we're going to get into some spoilers here. So if, you know, but I don't think spoilers is the kind of film that would.
No, I don't really think that this spoilers really affect this film, because it's not the kind of thing where there's not a twist.
Right.
There's not going to be like a big shock at the end or anything like that. I mean, you pretty much know what you're going to get, but just know that we're going to talk a little bit of spoilers, because I mean, honestly, this film is backloaded into its last, you know, act. So, I mean, if we don't talk about that, there's basically just a whole lot of wandering through jungle to talk about.
And that's one of my main problems with the whole film, is you got a lot of walking. They stop at a a village, kind of a, it was like a mission, and
right.
they hang out there for a little while, and then they right. keep moving on. And then the film, this is probably the worst spoiler of the film, but then they kill off the best actor.
yes, they do. I mean, probably a little over, you know, 2/3 of the way in, maybe. Okay, probably less than that.
We'll just kill off Stacy Keach here. It's like, why the fuck was he in the film again?
Yeah, there's a transition point where Claudio Castagnoli kind of comes in as the hero.
It's a tag. You're in.
Oh, hero. And I didn't really understand that transition or what his death was supposed to be about or anything or unveil. It didn't add anything to the movie, and really they needed a strong character like Keach's character in the back third. I mean, Castagnoli never gets enough characterization for you to give a crap about him.
Right, exactly.
By the time he's getting tortured by people. While I think Keach, you know, had a pretty strong character built.
Sure, yeah. It's like, oh, but no, you're done. Okay, right. Bye-bye.
I mean, I enjoy, you know, some of the walking through woods, you know, that's problematic. I enjoy the scenes in the village and the whole, you know, kind of betrayal of the chieftain and all that goes on. I like all those parts. I do think it gets slow in the middle portion, but I think, you know, the model of the cannibal film had not really been set in stone, and I think this was much more inspired for Sergio out of adventure movies.
And I'd actually call all the Italian cannibal movies action adventure movies. I actually don't like when they're lumped with horror movies, because they're not horror at all. No. Yeah, I mean,
there's horrific elements.
Right, yeah, there's definitely horrific things going on in the films, but to put Cannibal Holocaust in the horror section is really not just, because it's just not a horror film.
No.
But, yeah, and another thing that I found interesting about this film is that it seemed like to me, and I guess I could be wrong, it seemed like it was shot with sound.
I'm not sure about that. I could not quite tell. I know most Italian movies in this era weren't.
Right. Because if it wasn't shot with sound, the dubbing is incredible.
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to say. I mean, they did have two leads that spoke English.
It with severe... I mean, Anders has a really broken English accent. That's another part of another problem with the film is she kept saying cannibals and it sounded like cannonballs.
You know, I get distracted by Ursula Andress, and so I don't notice those kind of things.
That's another thing I want to take issue with. Now, Dr. No came out in like, what, 62, 63?
Yes, something like
now,
that.
Now she was smoking hot then. Now, it's 1978.
I had no problem with the way she looks, in my opinion. I think she looks great in this film.
Her body looked great, but she, dude, she's got a forehead that you could turn into a drive-in movie screen.
Well, I agree. She could have probably used some bangs or something like that, but in general, I mean, honestly, she was 43 years old when this was made, and this was before plastic surgery, was before Botox, this was before all the things that these, you know, middle-aged women keep themselves beautiful with now. I mean, this was a gorgeous, natural-looking older woman, and I thought she looked great.
I had to behold her. I just chalk it up to that. I would have rather seen Florinda Balkin or Edwin Schwanek or Barbara Boucher or any one of those actors in that role besides her. But in her accent really bugged me.
I don't know. I will fully admit, and I reviewed a Ursula Andress movie on my site today, and I will fully admit that I'm an Andress apologist. I like her later films. I've been a big fan of hers since I was a kid, and I'm still a big fan of hers. She's like 78 now, and she still looks pretty good. I mean, she doesn't look as good as Helen Mirren, say, but you know, it's pretty good.
Mountain of the Cannonball God.
That's a different movie. It's a pirate film.
Yeah, so, okay, and then getting in to the end of the film, which, yeah, like we've said, is like they crammed all this, like, okay, now it's a cannibal movie in the last 20 minutes. And it, I mean, it, like I said, it basically set up what cannibal movies would be like after that. Because prior to that, there was Man from Deep River.
Right.
Which I really can't, it's lumped with those other cannibal films, but really it's Man from Deep River is actually A Man Called Horace set in Thailand.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Definitely is. It's definitely that movie again, or for a more recent, you know, if y'all don't know what A Man Called Horace is, it's Avatar with cannibals.
Yeah. But yeah, so yeah, I give it credit for creating the kind of movies that I like, but I just could not. And the whole thing, dude, the dialogue, I'm just totally riffing on it the whole thing. I'm Mystery Science Theatering it the whole way.
There are definitely some moments like that, and towards the end, especially when they're dealing with the actual cannibals, it gets pretty funny.
Yeah.
But I found some of it, you know, still pretty good. I mean, when they finally reveal the fate of her husband, I found that very disturbing and nasty.
Yeah.
And I like that moment in the film. I'm a big fan of when they tie her up and smear her with honey. That's a nice scene. And actually, speaking of that, I learned a little bit more about honey torture today, and Wikipedia that shit, it is fucked up. So yeah.
Did you look up pig humping?
No, I did not look up pig humping, because this movie taught me everything I needed to know about pig humping. Because apparently, when you go into a religious cannibal frenzy, you start, you know, girls undress and masturbate on rocks, people start humping in the corner, and one guy with nowhere else to go will hump a big, giant, enormous pig.
Yeah, these cannibals, man, they party.
Yeah, apparently they do. They party like, I mean, I thought R. Kelly was going to show up in this shit for a minute. It got so fucked up.
And I think that's a big part of it, too, for me, is it's like, it's everything's so fucking random. It's like, what? What's going on? What are they doing? They're pulling big. They're pulling snakes out of this cauldron and chomping on them alive, and this is like
right. And the midget cannibal. You can't forget about the midget cannibal, because he's definitely one of the most random things about this. He just wants to fuck Castanelli up so bad, and I don't know why. So it does have some problems. I'm not saying, and I'm not gonna, you know, say that this is, you know, Martino's finest hour. I think it looks great. I think it has moments. I think that I enjoy Ursula Andress in it. I definitely enjoy Stacy Keach in it. I love Keach. I love him in a lot of his early roles. I've loved him in Mike Hammer. I'm just a big Keach proponent.
I think it's funny that his next movie was Up in Smoke.
yeah, exactly. So he was kind of all over the place with this one.
And that's just the thing, is that as soon as he comes on the screen, he's got the screen presence. You're like, oh, he's either going to be the hero or he's going to turn and be like the main villain. But it's like, right. No, he's just going to die in the middle of the movie for no reason.
Yeah, I mean, this is, like I said, I've seen this a couple of times, and I was watching this before the show, and I never will tell my wife what's going to happen in a movie, even if she's seen it. She goes, I can't remember if he's good or bad.
That was the cool thing, because there's this era of mystery, right, to him.
Especially when they kind of allude that he had been captured by the cannibals and escaped, and he gets this wild look on his face, and he's like, nobody forgets the taste of human flesh. And it's a great over-the-top moment that I kind of wish there had been more of that in the film. It definitely would have bumped it up.
Yeah, this film takes too many wrong turns, and it just seems like it was just thrown together, and there was moments that really just pissed me off.
Right. Well, thrown together or not, this is one that I enjoy what it is. Like I say, I've watched it several times. I will fully admit that Ursula Andress's appearance in the film is probably one of the reasons I've watched it multiple times.
And you could actually watch the movie on her forehead.
Maybe. I'd rather watch it on her boobs. But that's just me. So I hope my wife doesn't listen to that part. Oh, shit, she's gone. Oh, well. It's not a big surprise for her. In the end, I think this is a good middle-of-the-road effort. Definitely not a classic. But, I mean, if you like Martino and you've seen a lot of his other films, I think this is a good one to add to your repertoire of films you've seen just to get perspective on another trend he followed and kind of made a film out of.
Well, it's 2 weeks in a row we're going to disagree here because I'm saying that this is a mess. And almost every other cannibal movie that I've seen, with the exception of Jess Franco's Cannibals, which gets my votes for one of the worst, there's so many better cannibal movies than this that try a whole lot harder. Now, I will say that, like you pointed out, the film does look great. And that has a lot to do with Sergio Martino, but I can't recommend this movie just because it looks good, because it's a sloppy mess, it's pointless, the end is just retarded, and I just didn't like it.
Alright, so I'm taking this gets your first damnation, sir.
Yes, right to hell.
Alright, so that's 2 weeks in a row, but we've been on different sides of this. Now, I didn't love this movie like you liked Dead Snow last week, so I'm going to give this a purgatory of lost films. Like I say, it's middle of the road. I think it's enjoyable, but it's definitely not going to be for everyone, and watch out for the monkey scene, because that's definitely not for everyone.
Or the pig humping.
Well, that might be for everyone, I'm not sure.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, I mean, come on. That was one sexy sow. Shit, I've said too much. All right, well, enough of that. We're going to move on, and we're going to come back here in a minute and talk about something that I think we can agree on, and that's going to be our bizarre treasure, Hands of Steel.
Proceed with mission as directed, and don't let there be any mistakes. Neutralize. Neutralize. No!
I'm the result of Project HOS-1. 70% of my body has been bionically reconstructed.
Can't let him escape. Go after him with the laser.
Just heard the trailer for Sergio Martino's Hands of Steel with Daniel Green bringing us what a great character, Paco Querac.
Oh, you've got to love Paco Querac. So let me tell you a little bit about this movie. This is, of course, our Cinema de Bizarre Bizarre Treasure for this week. Available at Cinema de Bizarre, that's www.cinema-de-bizarre.com. And this is about Paco Querac, who is an assassin working for an evil foundation which seeks to take over the political structure of America. They have poured tons of resources into making him a cyborg assassin with cybernetic hands. And he goes to try to assassinate the Reverend Arthur Mosley. But something's not quite right with his programming, and he doesn't quite finish the job. So he has to go on the run, and he ends up at a bar owned by a girl named Linda, somewhere out in the desert that I never could quite figure out why there was a bar out there. But it's frequent by a lot of truckers, and the truckers love to arm wrestle. So what's a cybernetic hand guy on the run gonna do but arm wrestle? And so he does, and eventually they try to track down their cybernetic assassin who has failed them, but he will have to fight to see if he can save the world and whatnot. And that's about what this movie's about. It's about cybernetic hands, arm wrestling, sweaty George Eastman, and John Saxon with a laser cannon.
Saxon with a freaking laser.
It doesn't get a whole lot better than that. Now, this was actually the movie that got me to Cinema de Bizarre in the first place. The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema reviewed this on their show, and this was one that, like, oh, I had to get my hands on, and there was just nowhere to get it. And they contacted the Cinema de Bizarre, contacted their show, and told them, you know, hey, we've got this. And so I got over there and I got myself a copy, and that's how I became involved with them in the first place, is wanting to see this movie. And I was not disappointed when it finally got to me.
Well, I suppose that would link up to me as well, because I first heard about Cinema Bizarre from your page, so it all goes back to Hands of Steel.
It does. We owe everything to Hands of Steel. It's like Hands of Steel across America. That would be a different event. This is a pretty bizarre little slice of 80s sci-fi. I mean, definitely kind of taking off from The Terminator.
Mm-hmm.
They were definitely deriving some inspiration from that. In fact, the only actual cybernetic part you see of Paco Korak is when he's working on his arm, a la Terminator. This definitely was owing a bit to that, but it's kind of like it was owing a bit to that, and they said, well, what can we throw in with it? Arm wrestling. All right, well, not just arm wrestling. How arm wrestling? Arm wrestling with rattlesnakes. Yeah, obviously. So that's what they did, and it makes for a pretty good, silly amount of fun. I mean, Daniel Green is a pretty flat actor in whatever you see him in.
Right.
Luckily, he was playing a cyborg in this, so...
Right, it fit, right.
It kind of fit. I mean, when you see him in, say, the Elvira movie, you know, you gotta wonder why he doesn't have any kind of reaction. Maybe he was still a cyborg. I don't know.
Yeah, it could be.
But for my money, the real best part of this movie, or the funnest part of this movie, is the character of Raoul, played by that man among men, George Eastman.
Yep.
He's definitely an imposing figure. I mean, the man is huge.
Yeah.
I mean, I think he's like 6'4" or 6'5", something like that.
Yep, somewhere around there.
He has an outrageous accent in this movie.
No keys for the wiener?
Yes, he definitely wants a keys on his wiener. He's part of one of my favorite scenes in the movie is when he sends a threat to Paco written on a piece of toilet paper, and Paco answers his threat by writing his own response down on a piece of the marble countertop, breaking it off and chucking it back at Eastman. This is a movie I like to show my friends who aren't so into kind of trashy Italian cinema, and that's generally the point right then where they go, oh, this is a lot of fun.
And I think a lot of the fun comes from it being a very 80s movie. Very 80s. So people in our age group, you know, we really relate to that era of pop culture, and it's really filled with that vibe.
Right. Yeah, it definitely is. I mean, it's got that pop culture vibe. It's got the female love interest for Paco Korak is played by Janet Argan, and she seemed to be like the poor man's Kathleen Turner. She kind of had this kind of air about her and huskiness to her voice that seemed a little bit like Kathleen, but just kind of like the off-brand version.
Right.
This also had Claudio Castagnoli in it, who we just talked about a little while ago.
Yeah.
And one of the sad things about this movie, as much as I love it, it's always tinged with a little bit with sadness watching it. He plays one of the assassins sent to kill Paco Korak, and he has many shots from a helicopter where he's trying to gun him down. Actually, that helicopter crashed during the making of this film, and Castagnoli died.
Yep.
So that's definitely something. Every time I watch it, you know, I enjoy the movie, but at the same time, every time Claudio shows up, I go like, oh, I hate it that, you know. I mean, as much as I like this movie, Hands of Steel was not a movie to die for.
That's what I was saying. Like, poor guy's last film was Hands of Steel.
Yeah, I mean, that is kind of sad. I mean, it's too bad. I enjoyed his performance and definitely his scenes with, he has kind of a Silent Bob style partner.
Mm-hmm.
This little bearded fellow that follows him around all over the place.
Yeah.
And I guess it was his heterosexual life partner.
Right.
And I enjoy just seeing those two together in this film. I mean, all the characters are really interesting throughout, from the big bald guy that does the rattlesnake arm wrestling, you know, all the way to John Saxon and his crazy, you know, leader of this rebellious foundation. I mean, all the actors were really interesting.
Well, what I found interesting as well is that this film predates Sylvester Stallone's Over the Top.
Right, yeah.
As well as RoboCop, which both those films seem to take from this a little bit, because I mean, Green's character is essentially a cyborg. He's mostly human. It's kind of with where that differs from Terminator, where he was like a complete robot, you know.
Right. And he has kind of like that questioning his programming and whatnot that you'll see in RoboCop.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. I mean, there definitely is that element. I think, you know, Over the Top definitely takes arm wrestling to a different weird place that's kind of got some pedophilia going on or something. It's kind of strange.
and the main villain of that is a big fat bald guy with a goatee, just like in the film.
That's true. So I guess when it comes to arm wrestling, that's what you look for. I mean, this movie, I mean, it's not Citizen Kane.
No, we should probably say, I mean, we both love this film, but it's a very cheesy 80s low budget Italian film. I mean, you got to know what you're expecting coming into this. If you don't think that's something that would appeal to you,
then it's probably not.
Yeah. You're right, but I mean, it's for what it is, it's a very entertaining film.
Yeah, I mean, I think this is a film though, I think, that will appeal to a broader spectrum than say some of, you know, definitely Cannibal God and probably even Torso. I think this is a film that's going to appeal to a lot of people in the kind of like, you know, 25 to 35 year old age group that remember a lot of really cheap sci-fi, you know, being on TV in the early 80s.
And like most 80s films, it's got a driving synthesizer score from Claudio Simonetti, of all people.
Oh, yeah, so he of Goblin fame,
mm-hmm,
showing up here to do the duties. And I actually really like the score of this one. I mean, I normally don't like stuff from this later era of Italian film where it gets really, really heavily dependent on the synth.
I like this one as well. My only problem with it, which really isn't that much of a problem at all, is that a lot of Claudio Simonetti's 80s synth scores sounded very similar.
Treading a lot of the same ground.
But,
right. Well, it was working here, that's all I know. So, this is definitely one we both recommend.
Mm-hmm.
You check out from Cinema to Bazaar. Now, like we said, know what you're getting into, but, you know, I think if this kind of thing appeals to you, you're really going to have a good time. So, check it out and tell the folks over at Cinema to Bazaar that we sent you.
I don't know if you've checked out my banner lately, but Paco Querac is rocking the Midnight Confessions banner right now.
Nice. Well, speaking of Midnight Confessions, since we're getting out of our Bizarre Treasure segment, before we sign off here, I know you've got a lot of interesting movies coming up, some kind of mean-spirited, raw films.
Yeah, I'm putting myself through quite a bit here, and I'm doing it all for you people, damn it.
Well, good. So I don't have to. I don't want to watch most of these movies that you're watching.
I know. This is a catharsis, man. This is a flushing. These are all movies that basically I've seen, most of them I've seen, that I just like, it couldn't compel myself to write a review for, and they're just really repugnant, contemptible films, such as Murder Set Pieces, Necromaniac, I'm blanking on some of the other ones, but
I think I saw you going to Antichrist.
Yes, and Solo, and all those great films.
Wow, that sounds like a lot of fun.
No.
I'll definitely be coming over to ReverendFandom.com to check them out, but I don't know if I'm going to join you in watching some of those. I've seen some of them before, and that's probably about enough for me.
And I should probably point out, this is not something I'm going to cram all into 1 month. This is going to be an ongoing thing that I'm going to try and stretch out as far as I can, because I can't sit through all those movies.
Yeah, that's probably a good idea. Yeah, for I don't want you to show up next week and just be a drooling mess. Drooling does not make for good podcasting. I mean, you get stuff all over your mic and it doesn't really sound like nothing, and then people got to listen to just me talk for like an hour and a half. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so nobody wants that. So if you don't send in feedback, that's what's going to happen. Well, over on my side, I'm continuing my Shatner tribute this month. So hopefully I'll be looking at a movie called Kidnapping of a President, but it's on one of those dreaded short waits from Netflix, so you never know, it may be something else that I'm not quite sure what I'll be looking at yet, but yeah, we have that coming up. We've got, I'm going to be looking at Short Night of Glass Dolls next week. Next Monday, and that's about all I have coming up. I don't have anything much else planned for the rest of the month. I do have a ladies' night coming up here, where my lovely wife and her friend Frangoria are going to be adding to the Shatner month with Shoot or Be Shot.
Nice. I actually totally forgot. Yeah, I'm doing something else here. I'm trying to follow in your footsteps and do all this planned out shit. I'm not quite as good as you though. But
I'm obsessive.
I've got Shock and Gnaw.
Nice.
Cannibal films. Be doing a bunch of those, Italian ones specifically. And I'm also going to be getting into, speaking of Hands of Steel, 80s themed movies. I mean, really getting into like the ones that are just totally in capture the 80s.
Well, cool. Well, I'm not exactly sure what I've got lined up for next month, but you know, this month's halfway over, so another week I'll know exactly what I'm watching for every movie next month. So that's how I am. So come over to lightningbugslayer.com and you can find out what I'm going to be watching soon, I'm sure. So I think that about wraps it up for Sinful Cinema this week. We did all our begging up front.
Mm-hmm.
We talked a lot of Sergio Martino talk.
Mm-hmm.
And if you've made it to this far in the show, we appreciate it. And I want to give a shout out to Nigel, who I know will be listening to this show. Hopefully he made it this far without thinking we are complete dumbasses.
Yeah, he might have switched off halfway through, you never know.
It's possible, but if he didn't, hey Nigel, how's it going? So for everybody else, we will be back again next week. Let's see, what are we looking at next week? I don't remember.
You put me on the spot.
Well, don't worry, I got it right here. Put myself on the spot. Next week we'll be looking at A Lizard in a Woman's Skin, Lucio Fulci Giallo, and we'll be looking at the more recent Italian crime film Gomorrah.
Yes.
We'll also be bringing you some news from around the film world, and I'm sure we'll have some great bizarre treasures for you again.
And I'm sure we'll have lots of feedback.
I'm sure we will. I bet we'll have so much feedback, it'll be like it's Hendrix in here.
All feedback show.
Right, all feedback. We want to do like 10 minutes of reviews. Just like, yeah, I like that movie. Yeah, I like this one. Now we got an hour of feedback. So that's what we want. We challenge you. Give us an hour of feedback. Or, you know, 2-3 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Right. Either one. We're fine. We're easy to get along with. So until next week, this is TL Bug saying keep sinning. And from my esteemed colleague, Reverend Phantom.
Later, freaks.
Once upon a time, at the foot of a great mountain, there was a town where the people known as Happy Folk lived. Their very existence a mystery to the rest of the world, obscured as it was by great clouds. Here they played out their peaceful lives, innocent of the litany of excess and violence that was growing in the world below. To live in harmony with the spirit of the mountain called Monkey was enough. Then one day, strange folk arrived in the town. They came in camouflage, hidden behind dark glasses, but no one noticed them. They only saw shadows. You see, without the truth of the eyes, the happy folk were blind.
Falling out of aeroplanes and hiding out in holes, waiting for the sunset to come, people going home. Jump out from behind them and shoot them in the head. Now everybody dancing, the dance of the dead, the dance of the dead, the dance of the dead.
In time, strange folk found their way into the higher reaches of the mountain, and it was there that they found the caves of unimaginable sincerity and beauty. By chance, they stumbled upon the place where all good souls come to rest. The strange folk, they coveted the jewels in these caves above all things, and soon they began to mine the mountain, its rich seam fueling the chaos of their own world. Meanwhile, down in the town, the happy folks slept restlessly, their dreams invaded by shadowy figures digging away at their souls. Every day, people would wake and stare at the mountain. Why was it bringing darkness into their lives? And as the strange folk climbed deeper and deeper into the mountain, holes began to appear, bringing with them a cold and bitter wind that chilled the very soul of the monkey. For the first time, the happy folk felt fearful, for they knew that soon the monkey would stir from its deep sleep. Then there came a sound, distant first, that grew into castrophony, so immense that it could be heard far away in space. There were no screams. There was no time. The mountain called Monkey had spoken. There was only fire. And then, nothing.
Oh, a little town in the USA, the time has come to see. There's nothing you believe you want. But where were you when it all came down on me? Did you call me out?